Okay, world, and for all of you lovers of a very special bear, today's daf is daf Pei Vav, and we're ready. We got up to the two dots. Okay, so we've been talking about just because we got into the issue of Mechila. And that was the question of whether she could be Meichel, the Ksuva, which Geifa had been sold. So meanwhile, we quoted Shmuel's famous dictum, namely that if somebody sells a bond to another person, they can only sell the ability to collect the bond, but they cannot sell the fact of the bond. It's still the loan that the bond is about is still between the lender and the borrower. And therefore, what Shmuel is saying is, that the lender can always be mochelet. So that would mean that if you went ahead and sold someone the papers, so to speak, which is what we refer to in English in terms of the document, you know, the lawyer will tell you he's got all the paper. So then if it turns out that you went ahead and were mochel, the underlying chov, then the paper is nothing but a blank piece of paper and has absolutely no value for collection because there's no chov to collect it against, right? This is what Shmuel was saying. But then the question is, does that mean that you're going to have to pay the guy back? Will you have to pay him back the face value of the paper? Will you pay him back the value of only what he paid? This is very much like the sugya that we had yesterday, because I mean, what happened over there is Reb Nachman felt bad that he had given an eitzah to his relatives because people will learn from that you should give eitzahs even to people who aren't your relatives, and there you don't have a heter, or you should maybe even tell them, you know, to do phony things, and the mamish become like a lawyer and so on. But it was very nogea because we didn't understand when Reb Nachman said to do that, to be Meichel de Ksuva, did he also tell her, well, of course, you got to pay the guy back for, you know, if you paid your 10 cents on the dollar, your mother, you're going to have to pay him back because you caused him a loss. But I mean, if she's going to have to pay him back the full value, so then what would be the point? What was achieved, you know? So let's think about those issues and also think, again, if there are ways out of this. Suppose you want to go ahead and you want to buy this paper. So is there a way that you can avoid the damage? So let's take a look at the Maimer of Shmuel itself, Gufa. And this is on Pei Vav, and we're six lines down from the top, Omer Shmuel. Amocher shtar chov lechavero, v'chazaru michalo mochel, for that matter, afilu yoresh mochel. So it's not only the original lender who can cancel the debt, it's also the heirs of the original lender, who now are the ones who are supposed to be paid back. If they want to be mochel, they can be mochel, despite the fact that someone else has already paid for the loan. Now, I mean, this leaves the door open to a lot of hanky-panky. You know, because basically the borrower is going to go and tell the Yarshim, you know, we could always make a deal. Because if your father got this money, so well, you're inheriting basically the money that he sold the paper for. So what I could do, you know, is pay you back 80% of the loan if you go ahead and you're mochel the loan. So, and that way, you get it. Not the buyer. They can make a deal even for 30%. I don't know. It's worth it for them to be mochel along because they're not going to be getting any of the money. So how can you avoid that if you bought the paper? So Ibikeachu says, Ravuna Bereidu Rav Yeshua, look, if you got any brains, you have to act immediately because what you do is before the guy figures out that he always has an open door to this hanky-panky by paying part of the loan, and getting the other guy to cancel. So what you should do is, especially if you're dealing with Indians and the loan is on a place called Manhattan, so you take out some pretty jewelry, you know, and you're mekarkeshle, you know, you wave the money in front of his nose. So you could take, maybe you have a loan for $1 million, you know. Take out like $10,000 worth of gold coins, you know, and throw it in the air and say, how would you like, you know, it would really be convenient for me if you would write me a contract directly and you would say that I have a right to collect, that would be a big help for me. And as you just make it seem like I don't want to collect a star that has an endorsement on it. You know, let's start proving the endorsement, whatever. Why don't you just rewrite the star and give me a star that I can collect to, I can connect to the old star. Of course, I don't want to replace the star, because if I do, and this loan was originally taken out, let's say 5 years ago, the original star allows me to collect from all of the properties that were sold by him during the borrower during the past 5 years, because it's all meshubat. So certainly I don't want to cancel that star, but what I do want to do is I want him to write that I am very happy at the fact that this gentleman is going to collect the loan directly from me. That's all. And that way, he'll still have at least the amount from that date where the guy says, you know, if the other one doesn't work, so at least he's got this, so that he should be able to collect. All right. At least that way he's not out everything, you know. I mean, even if worse comes to worse and he loses the past 5 years of sold property, but he doesn't lose the loan. And he should get him before the guy wakes up to the possibilities over here of messing him up. So write out a new shtar that is based on the original loan, and he'll say that I'm mechayev myself now directly to him. Now, what about the fact that you caused, by your mechila of the loan, you caused this guy a tremendous loss? Well, that is cause, right? Now, cause is a grama. Now, we know that there is a type of grama, which is called garmi, which is literally the subjects of entire books as to what exactly characterizes a direct causal loss or an indirect causal loss. The direct causal is called garmi. The indirect is called grama. There are those who are medayik that Rashi doesn't even hold there's a difference between groma and garmi. There's so many different shitas in this that here, of course, is not the place to go into it. But if you hold like Rabbi Meir, and Rabbi Meir is doing dina de garmi, I'm waiting for Gavir Akiva, sorry. So, I mean, they have at least good stuff. Ah, see? Look at that. There we go. Put them all together. That Zoom heard me immediately, right? That's crazy. Oh, man. L'chaim, l'chaim. So, Amimar says, if you hold like Rabbi Meir, and you're doing dinner to garmi, so then you are going to have to pay him the value of the bond. So, because basically that's what you caused him, that lost. And that means that whatever in real terms, obviously that's going to be minus my collection fees and so on, but whatever it is that he could have gotten, could have realized out of this, you're going to have to pay it to him. On the other hand, if you don't know the Rebbe Meir, so then you'd be putter. All the guy's got against you is a piece of paper. You know, so when he said, I'm going to have the paper, that's really all he had. I sold you a piece of paper. Okay, so what's your problem? That you, I was mochel it? I mean, like, what made you think that it would be more than that? So that's just causal, and causal is not a direct chiyav. So what do you want, the piece of paper? You still have the piece of paper. That's how Rashi learns. Others learn that, indeed, you have to return the paper to the lova in the case as if it were already collected, and then it means seriously to give him the piece of paper. But then the question is, why isn't the loss of the piece of paper itself considered to be gromo or garmi? A lot of interesting discussion on what the real meaning is of the paper. But it's interesting that that's the way that we refer to it. Anyway, there was a maisa like this that came to the Bezdin of Rav Ashi. And Kafye Raphram, Rav Ashi, Ve'agve Beke Kishur L'Tzalmi. Raphram was so persuasive that whatever Rav Ashi wanted to do to be makel on the collection because of it's only a groma, he made him be medayik in every last issue that would have been a loss caused by the mechila, as if he was Michelangelo that was collecting a piece of wood that he was going to use for a ceiling, that he was going to be making the Sistine Chapel out of. He was going to be making absolutely perfect piece of wood that he had to make a these little drawings on, pictures on, and that needed to be absolutely perfect. So
he was on the beam. He was on the beam.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that, but yeah.
It means being exactly on target.
Yeah, I know what it means, but I'm not familiar with its marker. Yeah, I hear. Anyway, that's what Rashi learns here. Now, it's completely different Pirushim of Rashi elsewhere, and it's from the Gemara, it's Mashma elsewhere. And by the way, I think it's an important thing to realize is that, as many of the Achronim point out, Rashi does not mean to be consistent. The reason that Rashi says different Pirushim in different locations is to make you aware of the possibilities, sometimes contextually, and sometimes even if it's not contextual, you have to understand that there are different ways of reading the Gemara. I'm not going to bring you 15 different possibilities every time we bring up this Gemara, but each time I'll explain it a little bit differently. You may have noticed that in this weird book called Frameworks, that every time the weird guy brings a pasuk and he translates it a different way, depending on what the context is of that pasuk. So anyway, there's good makaris for that, and we'll move on. Okay. Omar Meimar Mishmeder of Chama. By the way, one of the explanations of that is that Rav Ashi had stolen money when he was a kid, and that he forced him to pay it back. And it really meant that he forced Rav Ashi to pay back, even though he was a katan, he made him pay it back. All right, that's a whole big shaila, whether your mamish mechuyev to pay it back, whether it's just midas chasidas. Omra meimar mishmei Reb Chama. Haiman de'ika le'ktuvat isha uba alchov. Ve'itle ara ve'itle zuze. Le'balchov misakin ole bezuze. Le'isha misakin ole ba'ara. This is a fascinating issue. A guy has two chiyuv. One is for paying off his wife's ksuva, and the other is to pay a debt that he's got. So what he has is he has enough cash to pay off one of these people, and he has land to pay off the other. Which one goes to which? So to the Baal Chov, we give cash, whereas to the woman for her ksuva, we give her karka. Why is that? Because it's reasonable that each one should get what it is that they are deserving of. I mean, basically, the guy who lent you money should get money back, not should get something that now he's got to go around and wait months to be able to cash it in and so on, and get a buyer for the land. That's unfair. So since you have cash, you want to use cash to pay back one person, the one to pay back is the person who lent cash. Masha Einkein, the Isha, who anyway from the beginning was Makabelat Ksuva with the understanding that she was going to be getting it from, that she's really only relying on his real estate to be able to collect it. So therefore, she should be given the real estate that she was really basing her marriage on from the beginning. Not to mention the fact that she didn't really put in that cash. And therefore, it makes sense. Now, what if there's not enough for both of them? So, so let's say that he's only got enough property to pay up one of these two claims. By the way, of course, we're talking about that the claims have equal validity in terms of timing. In other words, both of them are dated the same day. Otherwise, we'll always go to the first claim, of course, because that's the first shibud. So if the debt preceded the marriage, so then the debt is able to collect, obviously. And we're talking over here where there was no other issues. That's a given. So now this is a bit of a problem because we had exactly this problem earlier. Remember, we talked about in the Mishnah that we should give in cases like this to the koshel. We had a machlokas. What is the koshel? So, according to Rabbi Yochanan, we were talking about the koshel being the woman because she's not used to going to court and suing, whatever. So where we had that kind of situation, we said, handle the koshel first. Now, what's weird is that over here, we say exactly the opposite. And therefore, Tosfos is like, what the heck is going on? I mean, we've already been through this, right? But here it says, give it to the Baal Chov and don't give it to the woman at all. Now, over there, one of the pshatim in the koshel was give it to the woman because of chinah. remember that we had to, we had two Purushim and Chinah over there, Machlokas Rashi and Tosfos, where the Chinah means to make marriage more attractive to women. So this way they know that they get their money for the Ksuvah, they're more likely to marry. Or Chinah was also the possibility of making the women more attractive to men, meaning in this case, we want her to be able to have cash so that someone else will marry her after she collects her Ksuvah. But in any event, here, we give a completely different explanation, and we say, give it to the Baal Chov, not give it to the woman. Now, the reason that we give to Baal Chov, remember, always, is because we take into consideration the problem of the loan market. The more difficult we make it to collect a loan, the more we drain the ability of people to get capital. So we're not going to have any venture capital and so on if it's going to be really difficult to collect. And because of that, we made a lot of takanas that in order to not be maksha collection, so because of that, we worry about it. And here we're worrying about it. So the question is, why all of a sudden, in this case, do we reverse it? And this is a Gavi moment, or if Moshe's here and he's ready to take direct responsibility, the question, the technical question is, Shalotin ol delet bifnei lovim. The idea of destroying the capital market, that's its official way to refer to it. Ni'ilat delet bifnei lovim. So we don't want doors slammed in the faces of borrowers because people don't want to lend. And on the other hand, we have the opposite concern about chinah for the woman, whatever it means in the particular case. If it means that the women will be more likely to want to marry men, or chinah means they'll be more likely to be able to get married, whatever it is. But that is two conflicting claims. So Tosis points out that we have two very different situations, because over here, we're talking about the problem of the ilas delet, because the guy is alive. And therefore, if you can't collect from your life credit, this is terrible. Why would I lend money? And a woman, as we're saying, a woman, it's not shaykh ni'ilas delet, because, I mean, she, as the Gemara is about to explain, we have Rish Lakish's idea that a woman wants to marry more than a man. So fine, Masha'inkein, in the other case, we were talking about where the guy was dead and we were collecting from his estate, there we don't have the same problem of ni'ilat delet, because when people can't collect, even though the guy is standing there in front of them with his property and they still can't collect against him, that's ni'ilat delet. However, they don't lend money with the expectation that the guy's going to drop dead. And therefore, the occurrences of death in terms of the estimation of the lenders is not that much of an actuarial probability that they're going to take into consideration and not being repaid. So therefore, that's one of the approaches. There's many, many approaches to how to distinguish between the mission that we had before in this case. But that's a very reasonable first approach. And it's lovely because it brings efforts to Rabbi Natan, but it brings out the different levels of concern and the way that Chinah versus Ni'ilat Delet is something that is primarily in our minds, opposed to the issue of like what we would call fair or something like that. Okay, so continuing on with that understanding, in this particular case, we say, my time yoter mimasha ish rotza lisa, isha rotza lihinase. Now the question would be, omelei Rav Papa Rav Chama, I heard, he says Rav Chama, something that absolutely shocked me, and I want to know whether this is true. Somebody told me that you quoted Rava as saying that if somebody owes money, I'm on Damascus Bay Zuse, and he doesn't have any cash, so he has to pay back Ara, Islay Ara, and the guy comes and he's demanding his money. The Omar Le Zilshko Mi Ara, so the guy who owes the money says to him, okay, look, you can collect from the real estate that I have, but I don't have any cash for you. That you said that Rava said that we can go and tell the guy, no, you sell the land for me and you give it to me. You have to go to take all of the legal issues in hand and you have to sell the land. And now in this case, the guy who lent the money, remember himself, He took into consideration always that he was going to be able to collect because he had a lien against real estate. So where would it come from that we're mechayev the guy if he doesn't have cash? If he has cash, by the way, it's clear from here that he cannot tell the guy to take the real estate, right? So karka, and Tosis actually points out over here that there are different dinim of payment. In other words, you are mechuyev, we see from this gemara clearly. If you have cash and you borrowed money, you have to pay in cash. However, if you don't have money, so that's what we're dealing with now. Do you have to translate the real estate into cash or not? And Rav Papa was shocked that Rava supposedly said you have to translate the real estate into cash. Fine. We'll see what the case was. Then we have the din of Nezek. And remember that in Nezek, the Torah says, Beferish, the idea of paying back with karka. And that Shova Kesev is Kesev, and that you can give him any kind of Shova Kesev, including the karka, and he'll have to translate that karka into, that's for sure. So though you caused the damage or did the damage, you're not mechuyev to sell the land. And then we have a din of a sakhir. A sakhir, well, you hired somebody to work for you, you can only pay him cash. And over there, if you don't have the cash, you go get the cash by selling your stuff and so on. That was the din towards which he was accepting the job. So we understand that we have three different dinim. But the question was over here, the gabi da halacha of a balchov, since he was semich on the ability to collect from the karka, why would the borrower have to sell the karka for him? So Rav Chama said, of course he didn't say that. Do you really think we're crazy here? So Rav Papa said to him, well, I mean, obviously they didn't make it up out of just air. Tell me exactly what happened so at least I could trace back what it was that people must have seen that led to them claiming that that's what Rava said. So Emali gufadu uvda hechahavi. Now notice that he doesn't say Emali easy gufadu uvda hechahavi, right? Now, normally we say Emali easy gufadu uvda hechahavi. That's my basis of saying that easy means easy-like, so to speak. In other words, where the story revolves around something that enrages you or engages you personally, then you say easy. I need to hear all the details slow and without your getting all impassioned about it. Masha Aimkain over here, it's nothing personal. I just want to know what the details are. Why would I say easy? So just tell me gufa duv dehechihavi, you see? Okay, anyway, so Rav Chama said, okay, I'll tell you what happened. The case over there was that the guy originally claimed that, yes, he has cash. You know, I mean, we saw that he's got cash in his bank account. So we say, okay, we want to collect that cash. So the guy said, no, actually, that cash is not mine. It actually belongs to a goy, and we couldn't. The case was over there that we were unable to act in court against the guy. He refused to accept the Jewish court. He was a strong man, whatever the situation was. So he was able, even though we assume that that's a lie by definition. Somebody's got money, it's his money. And then what happened was when we finally get the proof that he has to pay, the money's gone. So now all he's got is property. Oh, man. So over there, what Rava said was, who asa shaloka hogan? That was really inappropriate to claim that we couldn't collect the money and then the money suddenly disappears. And now we have to go and collect the karka. Excuse me. So then you're trying to get out of the need to go sell the karka. You go sell the karka and bring it. That's what Rava said. That since who asa shaloka hogan, leficha chasubo shaloka hogan. But it's, of course, that's not normally the halacha. Normally, Rav Kahana, Rav Papa, another issue over here was that Rav Kahana tainted that according to you, this is another one of Gavi moments, priat baal chov mitzvah. So priat baal chov mitzvah means that all of these dinim that we force collection based on what we call a shibud, liens, are the liens themselves a concept of a deraisa in which somebody gets a right to someone else's property, and that has a real basis in the Torah's definition of ba'alut? Possibly, if you could show me where it would come from. The other approach is that the din of paying back in all of these situations is based on the mitzvah. Shia hein shecha hein, shia lav shecha lav. It's all a mitzvah. And therefore, when a person is paying, he's paying mikayach the fact that Beis Din can force to be mekayim a mitzvah. And this would make a tremendous nafkamina. Let's take a look at the situation where, for instance, we have yetomim ktanim, right? So ktanim are not chayev in mitzvah. So if somebody wants to go ahead and collect, the court will say, listen, these are just kids. We can't be mechayev kids that aren't chayev in mitzvahs. We can't be mechayev them to pay back money. So if the din is an actual d'oraisa, creates a sense of ba'alut on somebody else's property, so then what's nafkamina? You know what their age is. But if it's a din in priyas b'chov mitzvah, makes a tremendous difference. And there are many other nafkaminas. Fine. So now Rav Papa held that the basis of repayment and the basis of the concept of liens is all the priyas b'chov mitzvah. So Rav Kahana asked Rav Papa, if that's what you hold, what would be the din if a guy says, I don't want to do a mitzvah? So would we be mechayev him in court if he says, I don't want to do the mitzvah? Now Tosfos says, this is insane. I understand. All through Shas, we know that what we're going to do is we're going to force people to pay up loans, right? I mean, it was the whole problem of whether we're going to be niskak l'nichse yitomim. Theirs were made an afkamina because they were ketanim. But we're certainly going to collect from yitomim or gedolim and chayim a mitzvah. So how come all of a sudden now we're asking, man, what if the guy doesn't want to do a mitzvah? Does that make sense? Of course we're going to force him. So Tosfos has a number of approaches. Tosfos says in his first interesting approach is, look, why are you calling it a mitzvah? Does it really matter? Because the bottom line is the court is going to go and take the money out of his bank account. So it's all very nice to say, yes, you know, you got a big mitzvah to do. What big mitzvah? In terms of the practicalities, the user, so to speak, in other words, the people that are dealing with the courts, they don't know the nafkamina, whether the basis of it is the chiyuv of a mitzvah, the basis of it is the reality of a shibud. The bottom line is that Beis Din acts out as if the shibud is a reality. So why do you call it a mitzvah? So it's a semantic issue, according to one of the approaches in Tosfos, which is fascinating. Completely different way of looking at the Gemara, right? But there's another possibility. That maybe the Gemara means exactly what it says. Maybe the Gemara means, I wonder, according to you, what would be the din if a guy doesn't want to do the mitzvah? So even though we know normally that, of course, we're going to be niskak to the nichse yatomim gedolim, but that is because of the fact that we're assuming that they want to do the mitzvah. But the question is, on mitzvahs that are things that you're given, you're promised schar for, and that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a svasita yashar v'tov, and so on. Maybe it's possible that if the guy beferish says, I don't want to do the mitzvah, so then maybe in Achinami we wouldn't force him. Okay, it's again, the semantic argument is like very, very powerful. All right, so getting back to it. So what did he answer about this problem, if it's priyas balchov mitzvah, and that would be the whole point, what would be the halacha in that case of lo nechli the avid mitzvah? Omar le tanina, b'meh devarim amurim, when do we say that you get malchus arboim when you do an iser d'oraisa? That's only when you do a lav in a mitzvah's lo tase. So mitzvah's lo tase, you're limited to malchus arboim. And of course, malchus arboim could mean that based on your medical condition, even one malchus is already the equivalent to malchus arboim. But if we're dealing with a mitzvah asei, where a guy refuses to make a sukkah, omrim lo asei sukkah, and he doesn't make it, or we tell him, get yourself a lulav, and he doesn't want to get a lulav, in that case, we keep beating him until he drops dead. What do you mean you're not going to do a mitzvah? We'll make you do the mitzvah. So over here, it should be exactly the same time. So therefore, since we're able to use this approach to beat him up, why beat him up? Just take the money directly from his bank account. So it boils down, you're right, to the equivalent. That's what it comes from. But it's mukar is using force to be Mekayim a mitzvah. This is a more direct application to force, to simply take the money. But you understand what this proves? In other words, it proves that we don't need you to do the mitzvah. That's what we're saying. We need to basically get the same thing out of you that we could have gotten out of you by forcing you to do the mitzvah. So that's why it boils down still, even though it becomes now a court procedure to get the money, but it's a court procedure that is based on kofinoso. Suppose somebody says to a woman, here's a get, but the get is only going to go into effect after 30 days. Now, we're bringing this up over here because we had a big question before about tfisa. Remember, what is the din in terms of tfisa between Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Tarfon, and the question of where it was at the time that he's tefes, when we talked about the peros, that if she gets there first, or if the Yorshim get there first, but if it's in a place where the Yorshim would be able to actually be Kena, so there even Rabbi Tarfon, everybody would be made it to Rabbi Akiva, that once the Yorshim get it, the Yorshim get it. Now, over there, we had this nafkamina between the money, or the peirot, in that case, being in Rishus HaRabim, or being in a simta, or being in Tzidei Rishus HaRabim. The Gemara brings the following issues up, because there are many different variations of what a Rishus is, vis-a-vis Tfisa or vis-a-vis Kinyan. And the Gemara is going to be dealing with a lot of different cases. So remember, one of the cases we had earlier was a guy who makes a T'nai when he sells somebody a cow, and he says to the guy, the cow will be yours in 30 days, but he specifies that it's May Aksha, so that the Kenyan that you're doing the Mashiach on the cow is Chal now, and then after 30 days, it should be transferred into your ownership. So over there, we said that even if the cow is in an Agam, so it's in a swamp, at the end of the 30 days, since he did the Mashiach now, he is Kenyan. Now, this issue, what is the status of an agam as opposed to a Rishus HaRabim, as opposed to Tzidei Rishus HaRabim, as opposed to a simta, is actually a complex issue, because there are different reasons for the status of each one of these things. So the question, therefore, in the Gemara is, what would be the din of a get when it was put on the Tzidei Rishus HaRabim? So remember, there are different levels of Tzidei Rishus HaRabim. We spoke about Tzidei Rishus HaRabim being the equivalent of a sidewalk cafe. We talked about earlier where people will go to conduct business because you can't hear yourself talk in the middle of the shuk. And therefore, that's not a place where people will act out on communion and business. A sidewalk cafe, which is a place where people will go, is a place where you can make a kinyan. But how about a sidewalk? How about not a sidewalk cafe? So the question over there, when we're talking about a sidewalk, we have different levels of sidewalks also. We have sidewalks that are meant for the halicha of the rabbin, and they are not up against the edge of a building, which nobody wants to be walking and having his backpack being crashed against the wall, like when you try to walk along the street to get into the rova, where everybody goes into the middle of the street and stops the traffic, because I don't want to walk on the protected area where you have those poles where you're forced to walk right up against the wall. That's also a Tzidei Rishus HaRabim, but it's not a mokum that the rabbin would like to be. So it's more isolated in terms of kinyanim than a sidewalk where people will actually walk, and therefore may not be the same as the place that is private where I can do a kinyan. And what would be the status of a side street, where generally speaking, people are only going when they have to go to their physician's office? It's off to the side. It's not in the middle of the Rishus HaRabim. That's called a simta. What's the din of the simta? And what about a place where it's hard to walk, like an agam? So because there's so many different issues, the Gemara brings this up over here, but we're not going to get to the bottom of these issues here, because there are many different approaches that we've shown him and how to be mechalik the Gemaras that we had before about the Parah and about the other cases of Kinyanim like Tfisa, which is the main reason we're bringing this here. So Reb Chama asked Reb Chista, what would be the din of a get? Because the get has to be in the Rishus of the Isha. In this case, where at the end of 30 days, it's in a Tzidei Rishus HaRabim. And that's talking about, Rashi says, this is the Tzidei Rishus HaRabim, where it's like the case of the entry to the Rova. People don't like to walk there because they end up killing their backpack or ruining their suit or whatever. So that would be the question, despite the fact that we said before, as Tosis pointed out, we had right away early in the Masechet that Tzidei Rishus HaRabim have a din of Rishus HaYochid to be able to make a Kenyan. Okay, but that's a different Tzidei Rishus HaRabim than this one is. We spoke about sidewalk cafes or benches where people sit down. So again, Tosis makes the question, Rashi's Mefarish Tzidei Rishus HaRabim differently in the two cases. So it's not clear what it is that we're talking about over here when we call it Rishus HaRabim, Tzidei Rishus HaRabim, Mao. Well, Marley, so Rav Chisda said, well, if you take a look at Rav and Shmuel, said before, which we just had, like 2 days ago, Rav Shmuel de Amri Tarvayu, where Rabbi Tarfon says that if the guy died and there were Paris, and the question was, it got to be Tvisa. So over there, Rav and Shmuel both said, that it's only where the Paris are piled up in the middle of Rishus HaRabim. And there we say that the Yarshim didn't get it yet. And I'm assuming that Tzidek Rishus HaRabim would be the same as Rishus HaRabim, in which case the get would not be a good get. Now, this is an absolutely ridiculous Gemara, as Tosis points out. I mean, well, I understand. Obviously, the question took into consideration, Rami Bar Chama was asking, is the din of Tzidek Rishus HaRabim like Rishus HaRabim? So you bring me a din about Rishus HaRabim, and you're saying, and I would assume that the same thing is true. But that was his question. What do you mean? What do you mean you would assume? Thank you very much. You haven't added one piece of information. So the Gemara makes absolutely no sense, Tainus Tosfos. So therefore, Tosfos says the main point of the Gemara is that it's relying on the last piece, where over there we said that in a simta, for sure you can't do tfisa. So there it's mashma. If you're taking the example of a simta, where over there it's like really isolated, instead of saying something like Tzidei Rishus HaRabim to distinguish between a Rishus HaRabim where you cannot make a kinyan and an area where you can make a kinyan. And the only thing that Rav Shmuel could come up with where you can make a kinyan is a side street where nobody is basically walking unless you have a specific business there. So apparently Tzidei Rishus HaRabim would in fact not be the same as the simta, in which case it would mean that tfisa would be capable of being chal even at Tzidei Rishus HaRabim. That's what the Gemara is saying, in which case when it comes to a get, in a megureshes. And that's the point. So they imply, not that we would assume, they imply by utilizing the simta that Tzidei Rishus HaRabim has a din of Rishus HaRabim. That's what the Gemara meant to say, says Tosfos. Says the Gemara, but why are you bringing a raya from Rav and Shmuel? You could say just the opposite. What you could say is that she should be begureshet because of Rav Nachman's psak. The Rav Nachman, Omer Rabba Baravua. If somebody says, you do the Mashiach on this parah, but the chalos of the Kenyan will only be achar shloshim yom. So over there we said that he's kena achar shloshim yom, even if the parah is in the middle of a swamp somewhere. Now, I mean, I would assume that an agam and Rishus HaRabim basically is the Tzidei Rishus HaRabim is basically the same idea. People, if they can't do what they need to do in the Rishus HaRabim, you take a look in walking through the Shuk, right? So if you walk through the Shuk Machane Yehuda, so what's going to happen in a case where you're trying to stop for a minute? You're being jostled by people. You're trying to make a Kenyan. You're doing an exchange of money or discussions. I mean, you certainly can't stop in the middle of the Shuk. So what you could do is you could go into a simta, one of the side streets where people are not mamish flowing the way they are through the main Shuk. Or you could walk into an area that the street is so wet, it's like a puddle. You'll walk into that area where nobody's walking. And this is what happens to people. And that's it. That's okay. So the idea over there would be that an agam and a tzidur rishus harabim basically is an area where people will be forced over. To which Rav Kista says, I don't believe that that's true. I don't believe that an agam is the same as tzidur rishus harabim. That's an assumption. Now, there was actually the same sugya with the opposite assumptions. Ikeni amri. Others say that the first response of Rav Chisda was dafka that she is Megoresh, based on what we just said about Rav Nachman and the assumption that Tzidur Rishus HaRabim is to an agam. And Rami Bar Choma in the second version says, no, why don't we bring a raya from Rav and Shmuel, who contrast it with a simta, as opposed to Tzidur Rishus HaRabim, why don't we bring a raya from there? And my love, that Haini Rishus HaRabim, Vaini Tzidur Rishus HaRabim, in which case, if your get is Betzidur Rishus HaRabim, it's not going to be yours because it's in the middle of the equivalent of Rishus HaRabim. And in this version, Rav Chisda said, no, I actually hold Rishus HaRabim is not the same as the Betzidur Rishus HaRabim over here. And that would mean that according to the second approach, we're calling the Betzidur Rishus HaRabim to be the equivalent of an agam or to be the equivalent of the case of the Simta. So as you can see, we don't have a very clear sense of the difference between these cases. But we do have a very clear sense of Richie's sonar screen, in which suddenly this little blinking light popped up that says Mishnah, which even if you're fast asleep, as a captain sometimes is, the screen awakens you. Go for it, Sir Richard.
Zok the Helika Mishnah.
Interesting. What happens if a man has got a grocery store and he makes his wife the chenvanit? So he puts her in charge of the grocery store. Or what could be is he was mina apotropia. He turns her into an apotropis. Now, the real meaning of an apotropis, I'm going to be sending you a Portuguese word, which is the modern word, and take a look at what we call, trying to transfer something here, and it serves me right here. I never know what's going on. Sorry. But this is a modern word that actually means the same thing. So you make her an apoderado, which is an apotropis. It comes from the same basic word. That is to say, you put her in as a manager. We're used to using the word apotropis as a court-appointed trustee and so on. But the actual meaning of the word as it's used is not necessarily a guardian, but as a manager of your business. So you take her and you make her the manager of your business. As Rashi says, she hires, she fires, she orders, she writes the checks, and so on and so forth. Okay, so she's the manager of your business. Now, we do know that we have a takana in cases where people are working for you and they have constant access to your money. And it's very easy for them to embezzle. So the Rabbana, normally you cannot bring a chiyav on another person to have to swear that he did not steal from you, unless, of course, you have basis for a tviyah. But in cases like this, where there's free access to your things, then there's this idea that a manager will have to swear if he's under suspicion, and you don't have to justify, particularly an accountant that shows that he's been embezzling. So now the question is, what would be the din if it's your wife? He can demand that she takes a shvua that, even though it's his wife, that she has not embezzled funds. Rabbi Eliezer Omer, afilu pilchav alisata. You can even make her swear that she hasn't embezzled the challah dough that she's baking for you. Say, you know, Goodnick, I would suspect that you've been selling challahs on the side and buying movies. So she would have to swear to that too. And if she's been working with her times have changed, let me tell you. And if she's working for you by making these threads, you know, and she's maybe selling threads to other people. And who knows what she's doing with all of that money? You can make her swear that she hasn't been embezzling some of the threads that she's been making for you. So this is Rebbe Eliezer. So first of all, when Rebbe Eliezer says you can make her swear about the challah dog, I mean, does he mean that in the case of the Mishnah, where the woman was a manager, right? So then she's subject to the same as a normal shvua would be as a manager. So then you can even throw in, and once you're swearing, this is a Gilgal shvua it's called, right? That's a word for Gavi. Gilgal shvua. So ayadei Gilgal means rolling along, right? So it's a rolling shvua. Once there's a shvua to be made, we can include other things in this shvua. So maybe that's what Rebbe Eliezer meant. Not that you can one day accuse your wife of stealing the challah for Shabbos and make her swear in Beis Din that she has not been stealing the challah. All right. So in that case, maybe Rebbe Eliezer was only referring to a Gilgal. Or maybe he even meant Lechat Chila, where we're not talking about a wife who is a manager. Well, Tashma, Amru lo Rebbe Eliezer, Ein Adam Darim Nachash B'Kfifa. The Chachamim say a woman cannot live with a snake in one cage. I mean, she could say, I cannot live with a guy who makes me swear that I don't steal the challah. And for that matter, even if he accuses me of stealing the challah, what kind of husband is that? So it's impossible to live with a man like that. So now I think that that question would be only if Rebbe Eliezer says directly you can ask her to swear on the challah. But then Shapir, that makes sense to me. How's a woman supposed to live with a guy like that? But if you're telling me that only we're talking about over here, where this, it's interesting, by the way, we use the word megalgel. You know, it's somebody's megalgel money in modern Hebrew. It's a slang. But anyway, so this woman is being megalgel millions, right? So you want to say, okay, listen, you understand you're a big businesswoman. You know, we're not kids anymore. So you're going to be taking a shvua about embezzling those serious funds. So while you're at it, you know, why don't you throw in your challah and your spindle? So if you're telling me that it's Ayadei Gilgal, I mean, so I'm a big girl, you know, I'm not going to get all upset. The fact that you want to throw in an additional issue, throw it all in. So what's the difference to her? My nafka lamina. So it must be that we're talking about directly, right? No, please get out of here. A woman is going to, you're telling me that the woman's going to sit, yeah, I'm a big girl. I don't care if you accuse me of stealing the challah. Of course I don't care. What kind of husband are you? She can say, even the kadayak, the basroi kuli hai. I mean, to be such a kapdan on your wife, your dear beloved wife, whom you supposedly love so much and you trust, and this is the level of our love and trust, huh? I can't live with a guy like that. It's like living with a snake. So lomatzino de adorbada. So that has nothing to do with the issue. So do we know which case he was referring to or not in Rebbe Eliezer? Tashma, take a look at the following brice. If a husband did not write into the ksuva, this is how some learned that it was standard to actually write it into a ksuva, or no, that he just would write a separate piece of paper. I do hereby relinquish my rights to force you to take a shvua or a neder. Well, how do you take a neder? I mean, you can make a neder to say that something happened or didn't happen. Yes, remember we had this case in which even though they stopped making shvuas, but we can tell someone, okay, so aser kol perot ha'olam on yourself in the event that you embezzle. Don't swear that you didn't embezzle. Okay, so that would include that as a neder. So if you never wrote up front in a prenup arrangement with your wife that you're not going to ask her to take a shvua, and in the end, you gave her over the makolet, or you made her the manager of your affairs, or shemina apotropia, he can therefore, anytime that he gets suspicious, just like he would anybody else, he's mashbiakos manji yirtse. But if he did not make her a chenvanit, and he did not make her a manager, he cannot make her swear. Now, cannot make her swear what? I don't know. Let's wait and see. Rebbe Eliezer says, not true. even if he did not make her a chenvanit and he did not make her a manager, he could still make her swear whenever he wants. Because the bottom line is that every woman is a manager. She takes over the house, at least on the challah, though, isn't she? So therefore, she's got to swear that she didn't embezzle the challah, though. She'en lecha. Isha l'shalo nasek, at least al pilcha v'al isata, over her own cooking. And that's where they said to Rebbe Eliezer, ein adam darim nachash p'kvifa. So you see clearly that Rebbe Eliezer was talking about even l'chatchila shma mina. Another very important moment over here, assuming that the sonar screen is still working overtime on our very tired Capitan, who's been dodging the icebergs that are coming from the melting polar caps.
I've been trying to fix these pipes that are under the water, you know? It's a lot of work diving down, thousands of meters.
We know who's behind all of these problems. Let's not talk about it in public. Go ahead.
Zuk de Helika Mishnah.
Now, if he does write to her, and this is true even if he says to her, Neder v'shvua ein li alecha. So then he cannot be mashpia her. Now, again, it's not clear what we're talking about. We know for sure that there's one shvua that could always be a problem. And that is, again, Gavi, I think we might have this from before, but just in case, write this down. Pogemet ketuvata. A pogemet ketuvata is where a woman says, the guy paid me back, or my husband paid me back part of my ketuva, and I'm only entitled, let's say, to the remaining half. So then we make her swear that it's really true that he only paid half and not the whole thing. So in the event that he said to his wife and wrote to his wife, Ein li alayich neder v'shvua, he cannot make her swear, and we'll talk about what, swear about what. But he could make her yorshim swear. So in other words, he only said that you don't have to swear. Or if she had sold a ketuvah, for instance, if we're talking about the case of the ketuvah, well, they would have to swear. How can they swear? So there's a concept of swearing that is chal on a yoresh and on a purchaser. And that is that they have to swear that they were not told at any time by the seller, by the parent that left them this inheritance, that, listen, you should know that this was really already paid up, so don't try to recollect. That's what I mean. They can't swear to more than that, but that they didn't hear, and also that they didn't find it in the effects of the person who died, that there was a receipt that had already been paid. That would be what that would mean. And he never relinquished the right to get them to swear. If he writes, however, I have no rights to insist on a neder or shvua, not on you, not on your heirs, and not on anybody that is coming through you, meaning if she had sold it, then leino yochol hashpia, neither her directly, nor if she dies on her heirs, and nor on anybody that had bought her ksuva. But if he dies, his heirs can insist that she swears, because he didn't potter any shvua, only part of his own right to demand a shvua, and that has to do with the relationship between them, but it's not a direct legal mechila on the rights of demanding in court a shvua. So therefore, if the yorshim or the ba'im, well, they insist on a shvua, fine. But then he could go all the way, and he could say, neder v'shvua ein li v'lo l'yorshai v'lo l'ba'im l'rshusi. So then he's covered all the angles. Neither I nor my heirs nor anybody that's coming through me would have a right to demand a shvua from you or your heirs or anyone coming from you. Then they would not be able to make her or her yorshim or habaim bershuta swear. But hold on a minute. It really depends, because if she went directly from her husband's funeral and she went back to her own home and she had no business, further business with the estate, that's when this would apply. For that matter, she could even gone back to the home of the husband, her in-law's home, but she no longer touched any of the property. So then they can't make her swear. But if she became the manager of the property after the death of the husband, so from that point forward, of course, the Yorshim could be Mashbinota ala Atid Lavo. They can't be Mashbiah her on what happened in the past while her husband was alive. What the heck, says the Gemara? What Shvuah are we talking about? What is he saying, I won't make you swear? So Rav Yehuda Amar Rav says, he won't make you swear in the event that you were in a position of being the manager of the business. But I mean, that's because I'm asking you to do me a favor to be a manager, and I'm telling you up front, you do not have to swear, and I'm relinquishing my right. And that's part of the understandings of our marriage, that I trust you and will not insist on any kind of shvua. But that doesn't mean that if she is pogemet or ksuva, where over there she brings that shvua on herself. That has nothing to do with him. I mean, it's not that she's doing him a big favor. So fine, they never meant to waive the rights for a shvua on a pegima of the ksuva. Whereas Rabbi Nachman says that Rabbi Bar Avuha said no, even to the pogemet. Also, he said, you don't have to swear. So that was part of their prenup agreement. Also, Rav Mordechai, Amar Shmaita K'mayda Rav Ashi. So Rav Mordechai was very confused because he said, look, I mean, I understand. If you want to tell me like Rav Nachman, and that the reason that that he wrote to her that you don't have to swear was referring to Pogemet K'tuva, you have to think, I mean, try to be reasonable. Why the heck would a guy write something like that in a prenup agreement, which is essentially a ksuva, right? Because she thinks about it, right? In other words, she's worried about it. She thinks to herself, what's going to happen if Natsurche Lizuzi? What if I need money to support my drug habit and my husband doesn't want to give me money? You know, so what I could do is I could go to him and I could say, look, you know what? How about giving me a little bit of my ketuvah up in advance, you know? And then if I want to collect my ketuvah, if he actually divorces me, I'm going to have to swear because I will be a pogemet ketuvah, right? So that's something that people do think about if they have a drug habit or if they have a Netflix habit or whatever it is. So she's nervous about how do I get my money if he doesn't want to give it to me? And then what's going to help me to collect my ketuvah? So she asks him, okay, I want to have a prenup agreement on this. If I borrow from you against my ketuvah and so on, that there's not going to be any problem of a shvua. Okay, so now I understand why his prenup agreement includes this clause. But to tell me that he put into a prenup that in the event that she becomes the manager of the grocery store that doesn't exist, or of his big steel business, which doesn't exist, I mean, that's crazy. So what she thought at that time, you know, the time may come where he makes me the manager of a big store. I mean, nobody thinks that way. So the very fact that this is part of a prenup implies that, of course, we're talking about a situation that she was thinking of. And it must be referring to Pogemet Ketuva. So Va'amraleh, dear, she says to him, will you do me a favor, write me that you're not going to ask for a Shvuah. This is 20 years later that he opens up the store. She didn't know that he's going to make her a manager, that she should say something like this to put it into our prenup, that Armalek Tovli de Lom Mishabatli, there's no possibility of such nonsense. I don't understand how you could seriously consider that to be the issue that the prenup would refer to. Does not make sense. So how do you explain it? Says the Gemara that Inachinami, the reason that you're asking me that question is because of the fact that you have a wrong understanding of the machlokas over here. Omar Le Ravashi said to Rav Mordechai, listen here. You know why you've got a problem? Atona Hamatnitala. You understood that this whole machlokas about, is it referring to the apotropa or is it referring to the pogemet ketuvah? You thought that machlokas was a reference to an understanding of the first part in the Mishnah where the guy wrote her that I will not make you swear. So you're right. It's ridiculous. But that's not where the machlokas with Rav Yehuda was about. And what we learned is that it was only referring to the closing of the Mishnah. The closing of the Mishnah reads like this. If she goes directly from her husband's funeral back to her own father's home, or even if she goes back to his home, but she no longer has anything to do with the property. So then they cannot make her swear. Mashenka, if she did become an apotropos after the funeral, so then Mashbinota, but only Alatid Lavo. They can't make her swear about anything that was in the past. There is where the Machlokas was. What is the past? That's the question. Does the period between the death of her husband and the end of the funeral, is that the past? And it's included in the fact that the husband said to her, you don't have to swear, or is that the future? So that was the Machlokas. Rav Yehuda Amar Rav said, Al apotropia had nothing to do with the first part of the Mishnah, for heaven's sakes, about what is she swearing. It had to do with what's called the past and what's called the future. So Rav Yehuda said, look, any management that she did while her husband was alive, she obviously doesn't have to swear on that, was part of the agreement. But anything that she does after her husband's death, even if it's at the period between his death and the kfura, she is going to have to swear about, because that's the future. And that's where Rav Masnan disagreed. And he said, absolutely not, because of a special takana. Afilu ben mitalik fura lo mashbe inala, we do not make her swear. Because remember the psak in Nahardot, the Amri Nahardot, paying the taxes, buying the food for the home, and covering the expenses of the funeral, normally we need to have competitive bidding for all of these things. There's no din of competitive bidding during that period because the money is needed as an emergency. And we're going to say, okay, well, you know, we'll do one of these European burials. 6 months later, after we've had the competitive bidding, then we'll decide to pay for a funeral, as Richie can describe to you, if Richie's still there. But that is insane. So therefore, even though in needing to sell property right away, there's obviously going to be an unavoidable decline in the value of the property because people know you need to sell. Oh, they need to sell. They need to cover the expenses of funeral. It doesn't matter. And we do not hold her responsible. Same thing is true for the taxes. That's all we need. Don't pay the taxes. Yeah, right. And then have the IRS come and do a taking of all of your money from your bank account. Get out of here. So anything that's an emergency where the husband died, therefore, when she acts, we want her to act. No, don't go away. Nobody else knows what to do. Get the food, whatever is needed. Pay the taxes. Pay for the funeral. That's why Rav Masa was saying we will not have her swear, not because of the agreement, but because in these circumstances, the Rabbanan were mitakein that we dispense with the need for competitive bidding, and we dispense with the need for needing to swear that there was no embezzlement.